Hello, everyone, and welcome to Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie and TV podcast in hours two. I am your co-host, TJ. It is now officially Pisces season as of today, February 19th, when we are recording this. So prepare for me to be even more insufferable than usual. And this is my co-host.
I'm Aaron.
Who will be insufferable in a different way, because he's an Aries and we all know they are.
Perfect.
Yes, and let's go with that.
Level-headed. Wise.
I don't know what version of Aries you've been researching, but it's not the same one that I'm familiar with. Anyway, what are we going to be talking about today?
We're going to be talking about a movie.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you all for joining us. Clearly, someone is not going to take this very seriously, as usual. Would you like to try that again?
Yes.
What are we going to be talking about this week?
We're going to be talking about a really cool movie that we watched before when it came out and rewatched for the pod, which we don't normally do.
That is true. We do not normally do that. Go ahead.
I was like, no, go ahead.
What is it?
We watched The Favorite.
We did watch The Favorite. And is it, in fact, your favorite?
It's up there.
Yeah, it is up there. For me, at least, as far as costume dramas. And you're right, we have watched it before, and now we're watching it with a slightly different lens, since we're doing it more of a, you know, academic.
Mm-hmm.
Which, admittedly, we're always academics.
Yes, the two of us. We can't help it.
It's, you know, I can't not examine things through a critical lens. But here we are. So, what is this film about?
It's about a couple of women back in the day, doing stuff with each other and getting in trouble, but not really getting in trouble. And that's about it.
Well, I'll elaborate a little bit. I don't want to get, you know, blow our load too quickly, but I will.
Wow.
I know. How very vulgar.
Spoiler alert.
Anyway, so the film is about three women, one of whom is Emma Stone's Abigail Masham, who is an impoverished member of, I guess, more of the gentry than the nobility, who comes to the court ruled over by Olivia Colman's Queen Anne, and her favorite at the opening of the film, Sarah Churchill, played by the divine Rachel Weisz.
Mm-hmm.
And then what succeeds after that is a duel, essentially, between Sarah and her cousin Abigail over who will become Anne's favorite and thus wield political influence.
And so that's how we get our title, right?
That is how we get our title.
For once, the title actually says what the movie is.
It is, yes, there is no ambiguity. And the fun thing about this is it's actually, at least parts of it are true. The large picture is true. It is true that Sarah Churchill did exert a tremendous amount of influence over Queen Anne, but was subsequently replaced mm-hmm. by Abigail. And, you know, now the rest of it, which we'll get into and why mm-hmm. we chose it for this podcast, is a matter of conjecture.
Yeah, we're going to have to maybe, I'm going to make sure I rein in TJ here. He's going to want to go wild on all the history stuff, but we're going to keep him focused.
Right. Although it is funny, and part of the reason I chose this film is because I'm actually reading a biography of Queen Anne as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so that's the sort of gist of the narrative. And I just wanted to speak a little bit, historically speaking, about Anne and the dynasty of which she was a part, because mm-hmm. the Stuarts were arguably one of the queerer dynasties of the mm-hmm. of the English nobility royalty.
So back up now. What are you saying? That you're saying the Stuarts were a bunch of homos? That's what you just said here, here on our podcast.
Right. Well, I mean, most notably, her great great grandfather James I was notoriously fond of young men in mm-hmm. his court. His most famous lover was George Villiers, the Duke of Buckingham. So whether or not Anne herself had physical affairs with her favorites is ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that she wrote a number of very passionate letters to Sarah Churchill, but, you know, historians try to hedge a little bit because, like, well, people tended to be very demonstrative back in the 17th, 18th century, so mm-hmm. we have. But sometimes I'm like, yeah, but it's pretty clear they had more than just friendship. Now, whether it was physical or not is an entirely different question.
Exactly. And I was going to make a big joke about that, but I'm actually not. It's just a reminder for our listeners that when we're looking back into history, especially back this far, it really is important to remember that a lot of our sort of norms and expectations about identity and all that kind of stuff would have been different,
right.
Particularly when it comes to sexual identity. Like, our current day understanding of just what it means to be gay, for instance, is still a fairly modern concept that wouldn't have been around,
right?
You know, for Queen Anne, like, you know, the language that we use wouldn't have existed back then. So that's really important for everybody to keep in mind, that when the historians are doing the hedging that we're talking about, it's not just a weird political hedging. It
right.
really is sort of, it does make sense
right.
that we hedge in the way that we
right. do. And we know even less about women's desire than we know about men.
Yeah.
just because history, as a rule, tends to be less interested in the affairs of men. And to be quite blunt, most people of the period wouldn't have even, like, not only would they have not understood homosexuality as we understand it, they wouldn't have even thought that women could have desire like that. Mm-hmm. They didn't even think about women's desires as being, like, autonomous at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really strange thing for us to think about. And I do think that that's, you know, I'm going to talk about this a little later, but I do think that one of the things that this film does very well is to sort of capture the strangeness of the 18th century, because it was a weird time. Like, it's not just the wigs, it's just the way that it's not formatted, but the way the film really kind of leans into the strangeness.
Yes.
Which most period dramas do not. Mm-hmm. Most period dramas basically immerse you in the world of the past, but it's not so different from ours. Like, the people behave mostly similarly. Mm, yeah. Like, the immersion is such that you can imagine the people of the past acting much like we do now. But because The Favorite is just so unabashedly weird, I think that it's effective in that degree. Now, whether it's accurate is an entirely different question. And the answer is in the broad strokes, but in the minutiae, not so much.
But it also brings up that question of accuracy, because this is about, you know, historical figures. There's always going to be that question about accuracy, even with a film like this that comes right out of the gate, letting us know that it's not going to stick to historical realism as its main paradigm.
Right.
The movie makes it clear it's not going to do that. But just because it's about historical figures, we're always going to have these questions
mm-hmm.
about sort of what's realistic. But one thing we want to keep in mind as we're doing all of this analysis, that, like I was saying before, because some of our paradigms would have been so different back then, we have to also understand that we might not even recognize true realism for its era.
Right.
Might not actually make sense to us.
Right.
In a lot of ways. And so that's the other thing to keep in mind when we're doing this. We always have to kind of keep movies like this at arm's length.
Right.
When we're doing our analysis.
And I mean, that's one of the things I think that helps The Favorite be different than other period dramas, is because, like, generically speaking, it's more of a black comedy mm-hmm. than a period. I mean, it is a period drama, but it's primarily a black comedy.
Yes.
Or even a tragicomedy. And I think that because it wears its absurdity on its sleeve, that kind of absolves it of the kind of persnicketiness that typically greets period dramas
mm-hmm.
from historians and other accuracy-minded viewers.
Exactly, because it's got that other genre that it can lean on. We can kind of say, well, what we're seeing is because it's focuses on the funny humor and the sort of the weirdness is the point.
Right.
You know, rather than, here's a bunch of information about the past.
Right, exactly. And it's not, if you juxtapose, say, other royal portraits in cinema, like the Elizabeth films with Cate Blanchett, or any of the 8,000 things that have been done about Queen Victoria, for example, like, those are much more serious mm-hmm. films. Like, they aim to be serious, and I think The Favorite is not, but does nevertheless have something fun and interesting to say about the nature of politics and desire, which mm-hmm. we'll also get to.
Yeah, but that's also what we say about most sort of like genre type movies, is mm. that the focus on the genre actually frees the movie up
right.
to do really interesting things, whereas a more serious take sometimes gets labored down in trying to be correct.
Right. Yep. And I mean, and it also absolves the film of having to do the sort of contortions that filmmakers often have to do in the public eye when they get called out mm-hmm. for their inaccuracies.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about performance, because as we know, I'm a star-driven viewer. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you're a star.
I am a star. It is true. I have to say that this film really leans a lot on its performers, and I think that they're the ones that ground the film. Otherwise, it is, to be fair, a very self-indulgent film, which mm-hmm. I'll also get to later. But because of the performances of the main cast, I think that keeps it from being just an utter, like, masturbatory effort.
Yes.
Like, they give it a humanity and a gravitas that I think it would lack otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And she, in that regard, is Queen Anne herself, played by Olivia Colman.
Yes.
Which, this is what won Olivia her Oscar, and I think she deserves it, because she really digs deep for this character.
Mm-hmm. How so? Let's say more about the performance. What really, like, what grabbed you?
Well, I think one of the things that grabs me about Olivia Colman writ large, and specifically in this film, is how she's not afraid to make herself abject. Like,
yes.
Colman is quite pretty. Like, she mm-hmm. has an earthy prettiness to her, but she's not afraid to, like, and I don't want to say that Anne is ugly necessarily, but she is physically disabled, and like mm-hmm. she has a lot of physical flaws.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, her gout troubles her. Her body fails her throughout the film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she is sort of subjected to all kinds of physical humiliations because of just of all the, you know, the suffering that she's gone through from, aside from other things, 17 pregnancies, which is a lot. And that takes a toll on a body, which this film, I think, really shows you how much 17 pregnancies throughout the 17th and 18th century would really harm a female body, particularly since almost all of them ended up in stillbirths or miscarriages. Like, that's a lot for a body to bear. And I think that Coleman allows us to see this woman who has endured so much heartache. And she's, you know, veers wildly between sensitivity and rage and happiness and falling on the floor crying. Like,
yeah.
But that could have been done in a broad way that would have made her, like, silly or laughable. But instead, there's a lot of pathos.
Yeah.
And even a queer sort of pathos there.
Yeah. And what I really love about Coleman's performance is that, like you said, she's great at sort of just doing the work of performing the kind of, you know, the kind of misery that is visible on your body. Like you're saying about how all of that stuff has the effect on the body. That she's great at performing that, but also in a way that is very self-aware, at least in terms of the character. Like, she makes it clear that the character is aware of how she comes across to others. And you can see how that hurts her, you know, as the queen, as the one who actually is wielding all of this power, to know that there are still so many people that see you as a joke.
Yep. That, I think, is really devastating. Mm-hmm. Like, there's moments when you sense her agony. You know, it reminds me of the line from The Birdcage, which I repeat frequently: I'm well aware of how ridiculous I am, that Albert says. And you get the sense that Anne also realizes how ridiculous she is, but is simultaneously powerless to stop being so.
Yes.
And that's a real tragedy, particularly for someone, you know, from what we know historically speaking, was a fairly competent person, like, but was just quite tragic in the circumstances that surrounded her life.
Yeah.
It doesn't help that she's surrounded by courtiers, with the exception of Sarah, ironically, of Sarah, who really just want to use her for their own benefit. Nicholas Holt's Harley is the most notorious example, which we could talk about Holt in a little while too, because he is always quite a fun character to watch. But, you know, I love Olivia Colman's ability to give us women that are deeply flawed but so infinitely compelling. And the only other actress I think who does it quite as well is Jessica Lange. Like, and I think both of them are extremely talented for giving us, like, this kind of abjection, and I don't want to get too academic, but in the Kristeva sense, like, you know, these characters who are just outside of the bounds of, like, social normality, but it makes them sympathetic in a strange, twisted way. And I love that about her. On the other hand, about as diametrically opposed to Anne's kind of, like, unruliness, to use another academic term, is Rachel Weisz and her Sarah Churchill, who is, like, this iron lady of, you know, rigid self-control, who just will not, who is very practical, clearly feels very deeply for Anne, even if she also sometimes sees her as ridiculous, but seems to be one of the very few people in the sort of royal coterie who actually respect her.
Yes.
And loves and cares about her, even if she is sometimes a little peremptory and quite willing to tell Anne ugly truths that she doesn't want to hear.
Exactly. It's like you get the sense that, you know, that almost sort of standoffish approach that she has really does come from a place of love. And again, that's, I think, testament to the actor. So kudos to you, Rachel Weisz, for pulling that off, for having a character who so consistently is presented as someone who very much cares about this person, but is willing to say things that are hard to say to someone that you supposedly care about.
Right. I'm thinking in particular of the scene where, you know, Anne has just had her makeup done and she's so proud of it. And then Sarah just says bluntly, "You look like a badger. Go back to your room and I'll fix it for you." Like, it's one of those moments that really juxtaposes Anne's sort of unruliness, you know, the way her body sort of rebels against her and, you know, the standards of good taste, and where Sarah's like, "Just let me do it." I that was a really sort of interesting and revealing moment for both of them. And I think that Weisz does a very good job of giving us a woman who, by all accounts, was a huge bitch. Like, I mean, the historical record, after their estrangement, Sarah wrote some very scathing things about Anne and pretty much everybody in her memoirs, and was not very grieved when she was dead. And so I appreciate Weisz's ability to really, whether knowingly or not, I think really gives us a historically accurate picture of what Sarah would have been like, and how, you know, she's clearly someone who was deeply competent, even if she had literally no patience with anybody's idiocy mm-hmm. or any shortcomings that she saw in others.
Yes.
But paradoxically, like, that's what makes her the one person in this film who actually is good for Anne, because she genuinely loves and wants what's best for her, even as Anne herself doesn't always know what's best for her.
Yeah.
You know, so I thought that was really interesting.
Me too.
And then the last part of this triumvirate of complicated queer desire is Emma Stone's Abigail Masham, who I think is also the most enigmatic, but also for that reason, the most interesting character, because by the end, she has everything she wants and is even more miserable than she was at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Look at all the stuff she did to get it.
That's true. And I love Emma Stone. Like,
He loves Emma Stone.
I do. And, I mean, I often complain of the lack of, like, stars among the younger generation of Hollywood. I think she's one of the few that is really quite talented.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is one of the roles that I think really helped solidify her as an actress to keep it, like, to that is of extraordinary quality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we, unlike Sarah, who is, you know, the sort of Iron Lady, or Anne, who's the more, you know, lachrymose
mm-hmm.
and undisciplined, Abigail was quite cunning.
Yes.
And very...
I would say strategic.
Strategic, yes. Strategic. And we don't really know that until, what, about halfway through the film? Like, mm-hmm. it becomes clear. Like, our early scenes, we see her being, like, clearly subjected to the rapaciousness of men. Like, we've learned subsequently she's been assaulted and mm-hmm. raped. But, you know, as she's riding the carriage toward the palace, this guy's jerking off in front of her, which is disgusting.
He's credited on IMDb as Wanking Man, by yes. the way. You have to just look at IMDb to look at how they credit some of the unnamed characters right. in this movie.
And so, you know, but as soon as she comes to court, she quick, and, you know, after Sarah basically shames her, which, you know, they're first cousins, so she, I think, expected a little more welcoming than she got.
Mm-hmm.
But she quickly gets sucked into politics because, you know, Holtz Harley wants her to be basically a spy. Sarah wants to use her for her own purposes. And then Anne also sees her as sort of this more welcoming, less dictatorial figure than Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
And then she uses that to her own advantage to climb the ladder till she manages to manipulate Anne into banishing Sarah from court.
Yep.
And then, but then she finds out that she is just as, she is much more empty morally than Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for all that Sarah was willing to pull the strings of power to get what she wanted,
mm-hmm.
she at least seemed to have a purpose. Like, yes. whether it was trying to get Anne to, you know, raise the taxes to go to war against France, like, she had a political philosophy
mm-hmm.
and an authenticity to her.
Exactly.
For Abigail, it's really just about revenge against the world, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because it's clear she's very angry and bitter, as she rightly should be, because of the subjection she's mm-hmm. endured at the hands of men. But then she ends up becoming just as corrupt as the thing she sets out to destroy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the ending sequence where she basically stomps on the rabbits that Anne keeps as living mementos of the children she lost is really horrifying. Like, luckily she doesn't kill it, but she steps on it, and then that's what sort of clues Anne mm-hmm. in that, oh, actually, no, Abigail's a monster.
Yes. And I was actually going to say, before you got to the rabbit thing, I was going to say how the way that you're describing the sort of conflict or the sort of moral dilemmas that Abigail faces and the conflict that creates between her and the other characters. Basically, this movie is Mean Girls
yeah.
in the Stewart era.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty accurate description.
But then we've got the bunny rabbits that mess it all up.
I was also thinking that it's also all about Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's also all about Eve, but with the Stewarts.
Mm-hmm.
With obviously Queen Anne as the Margot figure.
Yes.
I think that's interesting, and that's one of the things that draws me to this film is the way that it really subtly, and not so subtly, navigates the complex relationship between politics, power, and queerness. Like, they're mm-hmm. all very intertwined in this yeah. gnarled mass.
Right.
That I think the film does a very good job of helping us to sort of see how mm-hmm. those things work.
Yeah. And for me, it's also important that, you know, the three characters that we're talking about sort of at the middle of this major sort of conflict about politics and all this kind of stuff, that they're all women, because of the way that so much of the conflict for much of the movie is so indirect.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there's a lot of, you know, a lot of pretending to be someone's friend, a lot of things like that, as opposed to outright, like, attacking conflict, right. That kind of thing. Although there is some violent stuff that happens in the movie. Again, even that's done via subterfuge,
right.
Rather than the sort of more like the sort of stereotypical, man, I'm going to fight you type stuff.
Right, which is, I mean, when I think about period dramas, like, this one is part of the reason I'm drawn to this one and have been, like, thinking about it a lot, aside from just being interested in the Stuarts at the moment, is just how effectively it really helps show the nature of, like, court life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's very few films that I think are quite as effective in this regard. Shekhar Kapoor's Elizabeth would be one. Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette is also similarly subtle, like, sophisticated in its way of showing the nature of royal life. Mm-hmm. And this is one also. And I think that's partially because of the performances, but it's also the writing and the way that it shows how, you know, deadly and toxic court can be, but not because, as you say, of physical violence, but just the way that power works. Mm-hmm. And the way that one wields influence. Yep. In these moments. But of course, lastly, before we move on from the performance, Nicholas Hoult is glorious as usual. Mm-hmm. I find him just to be a fascinating performer, like the roles he takes on. Like, he always has a knack for capturing the ridiculous and the profane. And I love that about him.
Mm-hmm. Say more about that.
So, you know,
those are some mighty big words.
Those are some, but they just occurred to me as I was sitting here. But I'm actually going to stick to that because I think that Harley, who's the leader of the Tories at this time, the Whigs and the Tories are the two political parties. You know, he wants power and influence, but he also wants to end the war in France, again, for his own reasons. But because of the way that the film makes him up with the garish makeup, the truly excessive wig, which even by the
that was a wig,
even by the standards of this movie, where everyone, all the male characters are wearing wigs, that was truly something to behold. Mm-hmm. Like this towering confection of white curls, and I'm just like, that's why I say the ridiculous and the profane, and like he has, as Holt's characters usually do, this kind of icy aristocratic arrogance. Mm-hmm. It feels almost sociopathic.
Yeah,
because he's very charming and charismatic, but utterly ruthless and mm-hmm. utterly without scruple.
Yeah.
Like, he's basically willing to do anything to wield influence,
mm-hmm.
and that's including pushing Abigail down a hill.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting, because they're actually very, arguably, the two characters that are most alike.
Yes.
When it comes down to it. And they're both very good at manipulating mm-hmm. others.
Yes, exactly. And to his credit, the good Lord Nicholas Holt's character,
with Harley, Harley.
He recognizes that in Abigail pretty damn quickly.
Mm-hmm. Like, and she's, you know, a shrewd political operator, because there's this moment when he confronts her in the halls outside of the Queen's chambers. And, you know, she starts crying. She's like, I'm doing the best I can to spy on her. But then as soon as he turns his back, her face changes in a heartbeat
mm-hmm.
into something much more sinister and disgusted with him. And that's what I love about particularly the three lead actresses is how much they use their faces and mm-hmm. so effectively, and how much the camera, like, lingers on their faces as they go through different emotional registers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really extraordinary. Performance wise.
Yeah. In thinking about that performance stuff, I'll go throw in there for Emma Stone and her performance here. You introduced her character's name and you used her last name, but she got that last name during the movie. She gets married.
That's true.
During the movie. And there's this moment where we get to see her on her wedding night where you see her doing that wonderful work of having a facial expression that's so incongruous with what's happening on mm-hmm. the surface in the scene, but makes perfect sense for what we know she's thinking about. Again, and that's something, like you say, Emma Stone does it so well. And that scene is, I think, the perfect encapsulation of that, where, you know, of course, she's plotting, and her now husband is like, it's our wedding night. We should be doing what folks on their wedding nights do.
I think his exact words were, I'm hard as a rock.
Yes.
And it's our wedding
night. I was going to keep it PG.
This is not a PG podcast.
And so then she decides to lend him a hand, we shall say, while still very obviously plotting in her mind. Her face never changes.
Yep.
Wants to acknowledge what she's actually doing with him at that moment, and it's glorious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is, as you say, one of the best scenes in the film, even in a film full of good scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, you know, what also just strikes me is just how, like, ruthless Abigail is. And I think that's a moment, and you're right, when she starts, she's Abigail Hill, and then she becomes Abigail Masham. And how willing she is to use that power against anyone who stands in her way, including her own cousin, even as she, as I said, comes to realize the cost of that power, is that, you know, she's not nearly as happy as she thought she would be.
Yep.
But what I, you know, and I love the way this film is just so unabashedly queer. I have to say, when I went in the first time, when I saw it back in 2018 and in theater, I had no idea we were going to be treated to, like, a love triangle. Like, I had no idea that's what was happening. But I think that's my favorite thing about the film, is just how queer it is. Like, and how, you know, how we get to see female desire having impacts upon who wields power.
Yes.
Because that is so rare, particularly even in costume dramas, which we have lots of costume dramas that talk about men, gay men, but so very rarely do we actually see female desire for other females.
And it also complicates that notion of sort of desire and politics and all that kind of stuff, because the very real question that I would have is not just generally speaking, like, you know, if we were going to try to use modern day, like, identity categories for these folks, what categories would we put them in? Because we talked about at the beginning of the podcast the limitations of that kind of thinking. But for me, given how driven Abigail is, it brings up the fair question. Like, what is she using sex for? Is it just power?
Right.
Is there desire at all? You know, is any of that real?
Right.
Or is it just a naked power grab?
Well, I mean, I would argue, at least from what the film gives us, is that Abigail has basically had whatever desire she might have had crushed out of her by a life of sexual assault. And, like, and because in this world, which is accurate, and I, you know, sex is power, and therefore, and you, men usually use it disproportionately against women. Therefore, for her, from her point of view, like, why shouldn't I do the thing that has been so frequently used against me?
Exactly. And then that's what makes it, for me, such an interesting question, because we were, you know, using words like desire and all the kind of stuff, but that's with the presumption that the framework of desire even applies here. And for her character, that's a real question.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I just a brief sidebar. I'm glad that the film addresses issues of sexual assault, but doesn't show them. Like, I appreciate that, because it's so often the case that period dramas love to show rape for some reason. I'm glad this one does not.
Yeah. And I love that, because it didn't do that, it leaves that as a major part of her backstory.
Right.
So that, which for me again raises the question about how all of this stuff comes up. It's like, I don't have the luxury of assuming that she is just sort of like acting with agency out of desire until we see something happen or that makes us question that. That's part of her package as a character, is that that's already in there.
Right.
And so it sort of leaves that question all the way through all of her interactions with folks, is like, how much of this is her doing something because she wants to do that thing, and how much of her is going, well, what's the point? She talks about how she's already given her body, you know, to folks, and folks have taken her body in all of these ways before. So who cares at this point? It's like, why not just do more of this if it's going to get me what I want?
Exactly. And I mean, in that sense, like, she, it's so interesting that you put it that way, because that's what makes her both very similar to, but also very different from Sarah. Because Sarah has a physical and sexual relationship with Anne. And she's not afraid to use Anne for her own ends, but she also loves and cares about her.
Yeah.
And I don't think that for Sarah, at least the way that it's presented, I don't think her sexual relationship with Anne is a means of manipulation. Like, it seems to me genuine, and, like, there's genuine desire there. In part because they have such a long relationship. We know from the diegesis that they have been friends since they were children. They have affectionate nicknames, Mrs. Morley and Mrs. Freeman, for each other. And that stays true for most of the film until Abigail's influence starts to really exert itself. And even Anne also has a lot of desire for Sarah. And her, she has desire for Abigail, too, but it's of a very different kind. And even that becomes a matter of power, particularly in the end.
Yes.
So, in this film, like, usually this, the sex scenes happen when Anne is in pain and, like, she asks them to massage her legs, and then it turns into sexy time. At least with Abigail.
Yes.
And the last scene of the film is, you know, Anne, by this point, has probably suffered a stroke and is barely, like, able to move. But she's standing and she's like, massage my leg. And Abigail does as she's bid. And then Anne says, I'm dizzy, I need to hold on to something, and like presses her hand on Abigail's head, and like it's this moment of mastery and desire, mm-hmm. like desire for mastery more than that. Like it's the absence of the kind of like intimacy and the emotional intimacy that she shared with Sarah, and it's now become just a pure matter of toxic power, mm-hmm. which is quite stunning, really, and it's in the way that it's framed in that last moment.
Yeah.
And chilling, I would argue. So, you know, I think that the film really shows us the way that desire can curdle, and whether it's physical desire or whether it's desire politically speaking, mm-hmm. can really curdle things. So, no, I mean, in that sense, like I said earlier, it is a tragicomedy, like, because it's characters who are all have their own understandable and explicable motivations, but they're all kind of like left miserable at the end. Because by the end, obviously, Abigail is like basically in servitude to Anne. Anne is clearly dying. And Sarah has been banished from England. Yeah. So, you know, nobody ends up happy in the end.
Just like life.
Right. Which, I mean, you know, one could argue that, you know, once again, queer people end up miserable, but at least they're not dead. And I do think that they're not miserable because they're queer. It's just this is the nature of royal life.
Yeah, wasn't like, pretty much everyone miserable back then?
Is well, yes. But, I mean, it's also the point that, like, this is the nature of royal life. Like, that it, in the way of power can be corrupting and ultimately destructive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really kind of like that. I like that we have a queer tragedy that's not tragic because it's queer. Like, yeah. the unpleasant consequences are not directly relatable to their to their orientations, whatever they may be.
Like, no. Instead, what I see is another kind of story that I actually am kind of happy to have an example of. And that's where you have, you know, your plucky outsider who comes in to kind of play with the levers of power.
Mm-hmm.
And they seemingly succeed, only to discover that by doing so, they've really gotten themselves into a world that they're really not ready for.
Right.
And I like that because for me, that feels far more realistic than so many of these other stories where the outsider character comes in and manipulates and wins as if they're sort of being brought up in a world totally removed from this has prepared them, but it wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, sure, you worm your way in to be at the top of the line of the people in the queen's sort of coterie of folks, but you weren't prepared for that life.
Right.
And now you've got it. So now what are you going to do?
Yep. Yeah, because, I mean, one of the things that, you know, although this film is very interested in personal relationships in the way that those play out in the kind of claustrophobic nature of palace life, it also, like, does make allusions to the larger political sphere that's happening outside of the Central Triangle. Like, mm-hmm. we get the English war against France. We get, you know, the relations of Parliament and the very scheming factions there. So I appreciate that, you know, we get these gestures toward mm-hmm. what's happening in Anne's, you know, reign that's not just about her relationship with Abigail and Sarah yep. Churchill. As important as that clearly was to her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I like that we get these moments, too, of intimacy. Like, it's not all just acid. Like, this is a very acerbic drama. But there are moments of genuine empathy and, you know, intimacy mm-hmm. that we get. I'm thinking in particular of the scene where they go to the spa and, you know, Abigail's kind of washing her feet while Anne soaks in the mud bath. And then Sarah comes in and gets in the mud bath with mm-hmm. Anne, and they start like mimicking, well, like, well, Mr. Morley, well, mm-hmm. Mr. Freeman, and they start like painting mud mustaches. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a remarkably like charming moment. Yes. And one of the few islands of like actual niceness between mm-hmm. the various characters. And, you know, it's very clear that Sarah relishes her relationship with Anne, even as she also, is, you know, recognizes the true threat that Abigail poses,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting because, you know, by the end, Sarah, for all of her prickliness and her flaws, is the one who's right.
Yes.
Not only has she been poisoned by Abigail and dragged through the mud, literally, and left with a very gruesome scar, which that part I don't think is accurate, but that's neither here nor there. But, you know, she's also seen herself plunge from the heights because of Abigail's duplicity.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, but she's like, Anne, I need you to know that I will never lie to you. Like, unlike Abigail, who will tell you whatever you want to hear, mm-hmm, I will not.
Exactly.
And that's what truer love could there be, which is a really, you know, sort of profound statement. And it's an indicator of the kind of person that Sarah really is.
Exactly.
You know, she was deeply flawed. She is very haughty and, you know, very presumptuous and really kind of tries to pull the strings.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that's a flaw in itself.
Exactly. But hey, that, when you're right, you're right.
Right. I mean, I suspected that she would be the character that you would most identify with.
Yes.
I'm probably more of Queen Anne. Yes. Yeah, I'm definitely Queen Anne. Very susceptible to, you know, whoever is whispering in my ear at a given moment. Anyway, we don't need to go into that bit of psychoanalysis.
Whereas I'm more the Ice Queen.
He is the Ice Queen. So, I mean, I appreciate that. And I also just like that we get queer, you know, whatever modern identity categories I don't want to use, but these characters are very queer. Mm-hmm. And, like, I love that we're getting unabashedly queer women desiring one another for whatever reason, whether honest or dishonest, and just getting to have that kind of fun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can see this film becoming, like, a classic in the same way that All About Eve is, because it's both, you know, it's about queer lesbian characters-ish, mm-hmm. but it's also just very arch. Like, how did I describe it when we were doing the pregame? I called it, and you were going to make fun of me, but the film's arch formality, as I call it.
And you see why I was going to make fun of that, folks.
Which, you know, I alluded to earlier the strangeness of the 18th century that it captures so well. But it's also just, it's one of those films that is very... I said this about Close last week. It's artsy-fartsy mm-hmm. in some ways. Like, there's all the canted angles that we get. Mm-hmm. Almost the whole film is shot from below.
Yes.
Like, the characters are always shot from below. There's always the fish eyes. They're sweeping through the hallways of this palace. You know, also the really obtrusive score, which really intrudes, not in a bad way, mm-hmm. but it's like, you know, it's clearly meant to evoke unsettlingness. It's mm-hmm. classical, and I don't use that in a very specific sense. I mean, just in the general way that people use classical music. You know, it's lots of harpsichord and piano and, you know, sort of very loud and in your face all the time.
It's exactly what you think of for something set in this era.
Yes, exactly. And I, you know, I appreciate that. It reminds me of the films of, like, Peter Greenaway, who also kind of dabbles in mm-hmm. costume dramas, but not to the not for the effects that most people watch costume dramas. Like, this isn't Bridgerton. This isn't Sense and Sensibility. This isn't, you know, all those other sort of dramas that are set in roughly the same period or slightly after. This is a really unsettling and dark and dangerous place. And, you know, we talked earlier about the way it talks, you know, this film navigates the dangerous nature of royal politics.
Mm-hmm.
And it's reflected in, like, the cinematography, but also the setting, like, mm-hmm. the way that characters are always wandering through the hallways and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And it also, you know, this being sort of like a dangerous thing, it also highlights sort of the, you know, the dangerous nature of sex and all of that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. We see that as well, not just in the way that we've talked about how it's been used, not just sort of as a naked tool of power that we see happening with some of the main characters, but also how it's been used as violence and intimidation against some of the main characters as part of their backstory. Mm-hmm. But even what the moments that we see, like the wedding night thing and the guy who's jerking off, you know, in front of, you know, we sort of see sex being used in that sort of, again, more sort of like more almost more about power mm-hmm. than about sex, but using sort of the trappings of sex for that.
Right.
We see that, and we also see it in the stuff that leads up to the wedding night, when we see Abigail and good lord, their husband's name, the guy she marries,
Masham,
when we see them interacting sort of outside, and it's like we see them having what looks like it's going to be one of those typical moments in the movie. They're sort of out in the woods and they're sort of playfully interacting with one another. We're expecting it to be this sort of loving moment where things get sort of a bit touchy-feely, but they basically start like wrestling with one another and actually going at each other kind of hard, like mm-hmm. actually tackling one another. And it's wonderful for me, like, watching it. I loved how unrestrained it was, because one, it was a nice subversion of how tight-laced things in these kind of dramas mm-hmm. are typically shown to be. It shows people just acting a damn fool, which is kind of nice, because I'm sure that that's historically accurate. I'm sure people acted a damn fool every once in a while back then.
Right.
But it also gave us a chance to see how Abigail would function in this sort of like sexually charged kind of way, mm-hmm. that she's actually holding her own,
mm-hmm.
you know, that she's very much fighting back. And it's almost like that he kind of likes that. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a thing that's like that there's like a positive response to her literally fighting back.
Right. Yeah, I think that's very true. And I mean, it's very funny because later when she sees Anne and she's like, what happened to your dress? And she's like, wolves. And then scurries out, which is very funny. And one of those moments in this film that is just tremendously funny. Like, it's a surprisingly uproarious movie when you sort of embrace the weirdness.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you just kind of lean into the insanity. Mm-hmm. It becomes very, very very black comedy. Yes. In the same way that The Banshees of Inisherin is. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that the recent film that came out. And it's also true that, like, you know, I love the way that this film captures in its cinematography, like, the darkness of palace life. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we have the many times where the characters are just wandering through dark corridors that are lit only by candlelight, as juxtaposed to, like, the more brightly lit chambers on the outside. Mm-hmm. I like those moments, first of all, because it's how you can do dim lighting effectively, mm-hmm. and, like, the sort of bleached of all color thing that a lot of CGI movies do nowadays.
Yeah.
Like, this is actually how you should shoot things if you're going to show things at night.
Well, they have to shoot it that way so that they can camouflage how bad the CGI is. It's like, the frame needs to sort of be dark so you can't tell.
Right. But here, I appreciate these kinds of costume dramas that show you just how, like, dark life was often in mm-hmm. royal palaces, like, particularly, yeah, like
literally, because...
Right, and, like, in the kitchen, for example, when Abigail first arrives, like, yeah, in like, the...
No electric lights, so...
Exactly, and so I appreciate that that's kind of evocative of what happens here. And as I said, you know, the 18th century was a very strange and sinister place in many ways, and I like that this film doesn't shy away from showing us that, including having a very strange duck race that happens mm-hmm. between the various members of Parliament, which, to this day, I'm just sort of like... I literally have no idea I'm not 100% sure on this, but I'm pretty sure that some of the most powerful men in the kingdom, as ridiculous as they could be, were not having duck races. But I mean, I'm happy to be proven wrong, listeners. So if you have some insight on this, please message us so I know.
I choose to believe.
So I want to, as before we finish up, I wanted to get your thoughts on the very last frame of the film, which I alluded to earlier was, mm-hmm. you know, Abigail and Anne sort of locked together in misery, mm-hmm. which is deeply symbolic and heavily weighted. But of course, that's not the last scene. Because as Abigail was massaging Anne's leg very unsettlingly, devoid of desire in any kind of pleasure, let me put it that way, devoid mm-hmm. of pleasure for either of them, really, the scene is suffused with rabbits. Now, diegetically, we know rabbits are important because they are symbolic of the many losses that Anne had of her children.
Yes.
Not accurate. She did have many miscarriages, but she did not have rabbits to supplant those. And so the screen proliferates with rabbits, which I remember at the time you being like, that almost spoiled the whole movie for you. How do you feel this time around?
I basically had to, like, mentally not watch the very ending of the movie this time because it was the same feeling as when we saw it in the theater back when the movie came out. I felt like the ending was so ludicrous and heavy-handed at the same time. Mm-hmm. it felt silly.
Right.
You know, to just do that weird, very long sort of crossfade with the shots of the rabbits overlaid over what was happening. It was just too much. It was just, it's like everything about it was ridiculous to me.
I mean, personally, I would have been okay with just the crossfade of Anne and Abigail locked in, like, eternal. Yes. Like, that would have been fine.
Yes.
I really don't understand the point of the rabbits, though. I mean, I understand, like, what rabbits symbolize in the mm-hmm. in the narrative.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure. We didn't need to bring it back.
Right, because it doesn't seem... I mean, it's about her children and her lost children.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really sure why they are coming up now.
Yeah. I remember when we saw it back in the theater, I remember hypothesizing, I was like, I wonder if there was, what we saw was not the original ending of the movie, if there was maybe a thought to do the ending in a different way that would reestablish the connection to the rabbits and all that, and try to make a point about maybe the future or something like that, but maybe that got scrapped.
Right.
And they ended up just sort of rush jobbing this ending.
Right.
Because it felt very much, I hate to use this term because of what I do for a living, but it felt very much like the ending to a student film.
Right.
It was just like very high concept that didn't land. Mm-hmm. It's obvious that the seeds were sown for it. It was like, I understand, like, it's not like the rabbits came from nowhere or anything like that, but it just didn't make sense. But it's like someone was like, this is what we're gonna do. And this is how the movie's going to end now, and that's what we're doing.
I mean, because Abigail's only relationships with the rabbits were the first time she sees them, and she sort of offers Anne a sympathetic reading of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what sort of helps sow the seeds of their relationship. And then, of course, the end when she's squashing the one with her slipper, which obviously shows her to have been deceptive all along. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really sure why they need to proliferate. That's what I don't understand. Exactly. I don't understand the proliferation.
It felt like, that's why I asked before. I'm okay, so listeners, I'm terrible about knowing who directed movies. I don't actually keep up with like directors, yeah, oddly director enough. Person. Mainly because I direct things myself, so I don't think directing's that special. But that said, when I was watching it the first time, and I felt this way when we watched it again earlier, It was like for the ending of the movie, it's like Darren Aronofsky took over and it was his movie for that final moment. Yeah. I'm like, why is this like black swan moment happening in this?
Right. Yes. I mean, I think there's a lot of, that's a very apt, I'm stunned by how apt that is. Because, you know, much like Aronofsky tends to be very self-indulgent and arch in his approach, I think Yorgos Lanthimos tends to be the same way.
Yeah.
And that, as the saying goes, a little of that, it was a very long way.
But the thing is, and what got me is that I feel like that or the opposite. It's like if the entire movie hit, if he had just been like, I'm going to channel Aronofsky for this entire movie, then fine. I would have been okay with it. But it felt like we had established a style that went through the movie that I liked very much. And then right at the very end, we go into completely different stylistic direction for that final moment. And I didn't get it.
Yeah, it was perplexing. And I also was just like, that's pretty much how I felt about it. It's like, the rest of the movie is really great. Mm-hmm. So the last thing I want to say is that the ending credits actually play out under one of my favorite songs, which is Elton John's Skyline Pigeon, which is itself a very interesting choice. Mm-hmm. Obviously, pigeons have also a symbolic weight because Abigail and Sarah often shooting at pigeons. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I think that's the implication. But even so, it's one of my favorite songs of Elton John's that doesn't really get a lot of love and attention, so it was nice to see it at the end of the favorite. I don't have anything sophisticated to say about it. I just really like that they included it. Mm-hmm. A little extra dash of queerness, as it were, just to get it to that little sting in the tail. I mean, it is fun when we see Sarah and Abigail shooting, because Abigail, or Sarah's basically like, piss me off and I will literally shoot you.
Yes.
Like, but it's, you know, as you said earlier about these veiled threats of violence, like that's those moments that make that most explicit.
Yeah.
So, in sum, we love The Favorite. It is definitely one of my favorite period dramas, just because it is so, it uses the trappings of the genre, one of my favorites, obviously, to do some really interesting things. And it's pretty brave in the way that it really breaks conventions even while also adhering to them. Mm-hmm. And so I think it deserves a lot of credit, and I think that its, you know, critical love that it got is well deserved.
Yes, definitely.
All right, well, we'll be right back. We have a special little segment where I'm going to put Aaron in the hot seat. So that'll be fun. So we'll be right back. All right, well, we're doing a little something different this week. Mm-hmm. As I think I made clear, I am a student of history, among other things, and I've been really fascinated with the Stuart dynasty recently. Before we did the pregame, Aaron's like, I'm going to need to rein you in so you don't get too caught up in history. So I did keep most of that aside.
Mm-hmm. And I'm proud of you for that.
But now I get to gush about it for about 5 minutes. So now I get to ask Aaron 5 trivia questions about Anne, some of which I revealed in the Digesis, some of which I just know, so I wanted to see if Aaron knew them, just out of curiosity. So we will see whether he gets these right.
Yes, we're already, I'm strapped in and ready to go.
All right, so who was Anne's father?
Who was Anne?
Are you going to take this seriously?
I will now.
All right, so A, James I, B, James II, C, Charles I, or D, Charles II?
None of the above.
That is not an option. So you gotta pick one.
Charles II?
Incorrect. It was actually James II, who was Anne's father and was deposed in the Glorious Revolution.
Ah. What was glorious about it?
Well, it was done with largely no bloodshed.
Oh, lovely.
So that's fun. He then fled into exile, and his son was known as the Old Pretender, and then his grandson was Bonnie Prince Charlie, who we saw when we were in Scotland.
Yes.
So that's that. Who was Anne's husband? Was it A, George of Denmark, B, Henry of Gloucester, C, Andrew of Sweden, or D, Gustav of Norway?
Let's see here. Let's see. We've got a George, a Henry, an Andrew, and a Gustav. I'm going to cut out Gustav just because. I don't have a reason. I'm just cutting it out. Let's see here. Henry is the second choice. George is the first choice. Andrew. You know what? I'm going to go with good old George.
You are correct. George of Denmark was the husband of Queen Anne. And, in fact, he was alive during the time of the events of this film.
Oh, lovely.
That was obviously not shown diegetically. Mm-hmm. Sarah's husband
would have been
shown.
A little awkward with all the girl-on-girl stuff happening.
And apparently, they dearly love... I mean, it is true. Regardless of what Anne's feelings for Sarah might have been, she clearly did love George, like, from what we know.
Mm-hmm. If people can love more than one person.
Exactly. And it is interesting, like, diegetically, Sarah burns Anne's letters, because after having threatened Anne with them, which was really the root of her downfall, since she was foolish enough to write such letters... In reality, from what we know, Sarah did burn Anne's letters, but we do have the letters that Sarah wrote to Anne.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really an interesting dynamic.
Yep.
So what important event in British history happened during Anne's reign? Was it A, the Act of Union, B, the foundation of the Royal Academy, C, the opening of the British Museum, or D, the founding of New York?
Let's see here. What happened during Anne's reign? So not the Act of Union. Let's see here. You said important event in British history, so I'm going to keep the founding of New York out because that's not important. Sorry, New York. Let's see here. The opening of the British Museum.
Incorrect. It was actually the Act of Union.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I thought the Acts of Union were before that.
Nope, they happened during her reign. Like, they were put into effect, like, well, they were, the negotiations happened during the reign of her predecessor, but they were signed in 1707 during her reign. So that was the right. That was the act that established the Union of Scotland.
Yes,
England.
I know.
No, I'm letting our listeners may not know.
Well, surely they're experts on that sort of thing.
I
right?
doubt it. Okay, what year did Anne die? 1705.
She didn't.
She is immortal.
She's missing.
A. 1705.
No.
B. 1745. C. 1714. Or D. 1760.
Well, it can't be A. So let's say B, 1745.
Incorrect. It was C, 1714. And it is true that she did not see, after their estrangement, they didn't see one another again, her and Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I found that to be quite heartbreaking, really, especially considered, like, dramatically speaking. Basically, Sarah's given a chance to apologize. She writes this letter, then Abigail burns it, and pretty much seals the deal. It's quite heartbreaking, really. Mm-hmm. As I said, it's a tragic comedy. Last question. What was the name of Anne's elder sister? A, Elizabeth, B, Margaret, C, Beatrice, or D, Mary?
Let's see here. I'm going to say it can't be Margaret, so I'm going to say Margaret.
No, it is not Margaret. It is D, Mary. Her elder sister, Mary the Second, who was married to William the Third. If you've heard of the College of William and Mary, that's who it's named after.
Ah.
And they actually came in as part of an invasion force, that's the Glorious Revolution, that deposed Anne's father. So he was deposed by his own daughter.
Oh, wow.
And nephew, because William and Mary were both cousins.
Oh, well, of course. Yeah,
First cousins.
All of that weird shit from the past.
Yep. So that's a little fun fact. Unfortunately, Aaron did not perform very well on this trivia contest.
Way to just diss me. You could have said, well, nice try, good effort, you know. But nah, you fucked up.
An A for effort. I still love you. You're not quite the expert on British royal history.
All right, so next week we'll do French history.
Well, that's fair. That seems
just kidding. No, nobody wants a podcast on that.
So anyway, I just find the Stuarts very fascinating. They are, to some degree, a tragic dynasty, like, because each of them had, you know, particularly vexing things happen to them. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Charles I lost his head. You know, Mary the Second and sister died of smallpox. William the Third died after breaking his collarbone and got pneumonia. So, you know, they're a dynasty that's not particularly, they don't live to be very old, and they have a lot of tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, one of the things that, to bring it back to the movie, that I appreciate about The Favourite is that it really allows Anne to come out in all of her tragic beauty. Like, I appreciate that about the film, that it manages to give us that story. And, you know, as a sort of melancholic person, that really appeals to me. And although, as we've said, The Favourite is a very bitingly funny and acerbic movie, I do think there's an emotional core to it that we should pay attention to aside from the humor.
I say stick to the humor.
Well, you would.
Thanks, Source. We don't need all the feelings. Just have the humor, and then we move on.
Well, I was heartbroken. I didn't cry, but it is still there is a poignance to this movie that I think lies underneath of its more sharp edges.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, give us just a moment, and we'll be back to do our usual little outro. All right, well, thank you, everyone, for joining us for another fabulous episode of Queens of the Bees, which this one doubled as a little history lesson. So Now our listeners know a little bit more about the Stuarts.
And so do I.
Yeah, we all do. Like, we all know a little more about the Stuarts as a result. Again, they are kind of overshadowed by the Tudors, but I think they deserve more love than they get. But I'm not going to belabor this, much as I really would like to keep gushing about the Stuarts, but I won't. Aaron's like, I can feel his, like, can we wrap this up, TJ? I'm sure my listeners are probably thinking that too. Anyway, so should I even bother asking you where I can find you on social media?
I said, go ahead and ask me.
Where can we find you on social media?
You can find me at TJ Social Media.
I think that is probably wise. As I increasingly grow disenchanted with social media, I find that to be more appealing as time goes by.
Mm-hmm.
But in the interest of being publicly visible, you can find me on Twitter at TJ West and the number 3. I'm currently on private, but you can still follow me and I'll follow you back. You can also find me on Instagram at Thomas West and the number 3. And you can, of course, find our very own podcast Instagram at Thomas West and the number... at Queens of the Bees. Sorry, I didn't want to duplicate there. Queens of the Bees, all one word. And there you'll find snippets of other reviews that we're doing, some of the things that we're watching that are not queer necessarily, but that we are still watching and reviewing. You can also follow me on Letterboxd if you haven't already. I do a lot of film reviewing there too. And you can also follow my newsletter, Omnivorous, at Substack, where I write a lot about queer stuff because, you know, I'm always happy to be writing about queer shit. And lastly, our usual little injunction that if you have the extra time, which we know you do, please rate us and review us wherever you listen to your podcasts. That helps to build visibility for a little podcast like ours that's not huge, you know, a huge blockbuster as of yet. Every little bit helps. So if you would take a little bit of time to do that, leave us either nice, glowing, positive feedback, which we particularly welcome, or if you're a little more curmudgeonly, you can leave us critical feedback. So we appreciate all of that, because that really does help, as I said, for us to build visibility. So, for Queens of the Bees, I'm TJ.
And I'm Aaron.
And we will see you next week. Hip, hip.